This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we're diving further into the Lindsay Clancy case as jury deliberations begin. She is a Massachusetts mother who is on trial for killing her three children. And the case has opened up a national conversation about postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis. We'll hear a listener who called in to an Odyssey radio station about his own experience with postpartum disorders. Hosts from Odyssey stations will also share their experiences and draw connections to past cases. We'll also hear about a bizarre development inside of the courtroom this week. In the first half of the show, we'll hear about new crime cases across the country, from a chicken shop killing in Brooklyn and a thwarted terror plot to stabbings in the Bay Area and an officer-involved shooting in San Jose. Then we'll hear about the documentary focused on the Jacob Wetterling case out of Minnesota. Let's start with that chicken shop murder from last weekend. Here's Odyssey Station 1010 Winds in New York City with the details.
Well, still no arrests after gun violence overnight at a Brooklyn chicken shop. Two employees were hit by gunfire at America's Best Wings and Pizza in Brownsville, and one of them died after being shot in the head. Police say they got a 911 call about an assault in progress at the restaurant on Rockaway Avenue shortly after midnight. Melvin Irby lives nearby.
Gun violence in this area can be bad, but like I said, I haven't seen anything happen to any of these stores. I really haven't.
A second man was also shot. The 39-year-old victim is in stable condition now after getting wounded in the leg. Police haven't released the name of the 44-year-old man that died while they notify family.
As of Friday, August 28th, police had still not made arrests in the case. 1010 Winds also reported on a road rage case that turned fatal last weekend.
Well, there's a manhunt underway after a deadly road rage incident in Brooklyn late last night.
A 27-year-old man is dead, gunned down just before 10 Friday night near Crescent Street and Stanley Avenue in East New York. Sources tell 1010 Winds it was sparked by road rage. Police are searching for a black Lexus seen fleeing and the driver inside. When the NYPD got to the scene, they found the victim critically hurt with gunshot wounds to the chest and torso. He was rushed to Brookdale Hospital but couldn't be saved. No word yet on what may have led up to the apparent deadly confrontation on the road. The NYPD's crime scene unit spent the night searching for clues as investigators try to figure out exactly what happened and why. Suzanne Colucci, 1010 Winds at 92.3 FM.
And in Queens, 1010 Winds reported on a fatal stabbing that occurred last weekend as well.
Laurelton, Queens, the scene of a fatal stabbing last night. Cops responded to a call outside 220-20 Merrick Boulevard. There, they found a 33-year-old man with multiple stab wounds. Jose Scott was rushed to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. So far, no word what happened and no arrests. There was a fatal hit and run over the weekend in the Village. A 22-year-old woman was killed while crossing the street at around 5 Sunday morning at West Washington Place and 6th Avenue. Corey Schwartz tried to help. He spoke to CBS 2.
All of a sudden, we saw a group of people screaming, and I saw the girl laying on the floor right here. So I immediately ran over and checked her pulse. She had a pulse, and shortly thereafter, the police came and then the ambulance.
Destiny Murrell of Brooklyn was rushed to the hospital. Sadly, she didn't make it. She was with a group of five others who were not harmed. At this point, the only info on the car is that it was gray.
On the other side of the country, Odyssey station KCBS Radio in the Bay Area reported on multiple stabbing incidents this Tuesday.
The Fruitvale BART station, it was one of four stabbing scenes now being investigated by Oakland police. This all started last night after 7 o'clock with officers responding to reports of a shooting at nearby Cesar Chavez Park. It turns out it was the first of several stabbings.
At the same time, another call came in at the 3800 block of San Leandro of another stabbing incident.
Oakland Police Chief James Beer says there was a third stabbing at the Fruitvale BART station and then two more on International Boulevard. That's where Beer says bystanders flagged down officers and pointed them toward the suspect, who fled on foot.
When the officers caught up to the suspect, they ordered him at gunpoint to put the knife down for the safety of the community and that of the officers. He complied, and he was safely taken into custody.
Now, there are multiple victims, one person deceased, two in critical condition, two in stable condition. A motive for this bloody stabbing spree is unknown. Live from the scene in Oakland, Matt Bigler, KCBS.
All right, Matt, thank you. Police in El Cerrito say they have caught up with one of the suspects tied to a deadly shooting at a local shopping center parking lot on Sunday. When police arrived to Del Norte Plaza afternoon, they found a young man who'd been shot. He died at the scene. Witnesses told police the victim had gotten into some sort of altercation with two men near his car. The suspects ran, but police arrested Jakari Gibson yesterday. Cops say the shooter and the getaway driver are still on the loose.
In San Jose, KCBS reported on an officer-involved shooting this week.
We've got more details now about the man killed in an officer-involved shooting yesterday. KCBS's Virginia Van Zant with more from the San Jose Police Department. Virginia?
That's right. So just a bit ago, we heard from San Jose Chief of Police Paul Joseph, and he shed a little more light on the history of the suspect killed in yesterday's officer-involved shooting. The man was 39 years old. His name was Anthony Chavez. Joseph said Chavez had been involved in crime for years, decades even. He had been convicted of armed robberies in the past and had been in and out of jail. In 2016, he was sentenced to 23 years in prison for an armed robbery, and he ended up getting out early in October 2025. Out on parole as a three striker. And Joseph said Chavez was seen just less than 6 months later in April in a stolen vehicle, and he fled from officers in the spring, that he had been continuously violating terms of his parole left and right, failing to show up for court hearings, failing to come and get an ankle monitor. And Chief Joseph was really just emphasizing that his officers have seen a lot of the criminals that are armed and dangerous out and about that have been released from jail. Here's Officer Joseph.
Arms in the hands of violent people who should have been in custody instead of terrorized. Over the course of my career, crime has gone up and crime has gone down. But what has become increasingly troubling is how often our officers are encountering firearms in the hands of violent people who should have been in custody instead of terrorizing our community.
And we also heard a bit more about the officer who was shot, Officer Matt Walsh. He was shot in the torso several times, but is in stable condition and is expected to make a full recovery. Mayor Matt Mahan was also at this press conference, and he said that he visited Walsh in the hospital yesterday. Here's Mayor Mahan.
By the time I arrived at the hospital last night, our sergeant's loved ones were already there, surrounded by his fellow officers and the entire leadership of this department.
So that's Mayor Mahan. Both Mahan and Chief Joseph were emphasizing that DA Jeff Rosen, if he had been here today, that he is on the same page, that the DA's office objected to Chavez's release and that he never should have been out and about and able to commit these crimes. That seemed to be a big theme of this press conference, just critical of how many criminals have been released and are out and about. Reporting live from the San Jose Police Department, Virginia Van Zant, KCBS.
Back near the East Coast, Odyssey station KYW News Radio out of Philadelphia reported on a horrific case of family violence in South Jersey.
A senior citizen from South Jersey has been indicted on a murder charge after prosecutors say he choked his own daughter to death. Here's Vic Ragapathy.
71-year-old Dennis J. Hall of Franklin Township, Gloucester County, allegedly called 911 on Thursday, June 11th to report that his 40-year-old daughter was not breathing. When emergency services arrived, officials say Hall told them he had strangled her. First responders tried life-saving measures on her and took her to a local hospital. She died from her injuries the next day. An official medical examiner performed an autopsy and determined the immediate cause of death was asphyxiation. Hall had been arrested at the scene and initially charged with attempted murder. After his daughter died, the charge was elevated to first-degree murder. If convicted, Hall could receive a maximum penalty of life in prison. Vic Ragapathy, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
Ragapathy also provided an update on a man wreaking havoc in a doll mask.
22-year-old Zamir Hughes surrendered to U.S. Marshals when they knocked on a southeast Las Vegas apartment door tonight at 8. That's according to Supervisory Deputy Robert Clark.
Tonight, the fear that one man brought to the Philadelphia community comes to an end.
Hughes allegedly ran up to people before sunrise about 2 weeks ago in Center City wearing a creepy Chucky-type mask and making threats. Police say he at one point asked a woman, "Are you ready to die?" Investigators believe he may have been filming the encounters for social media. Clark says he's been a Las Vegas resident since February. After the alleged scaring spree on August 12th, officials say he flew out of Trenton down to Orlando on August 19th. Then he flew to Vegas.
After being profiled on the news August 28th, he changed his location in Las Vegas and hid at an apartment complex in southeast Las Vegas for the past 5 days.
Marshals located and arrested him without incident, though Clark says he did try at one point to escape his cuffs. And now he's being held at a Nevada detention center. He's awaiting extradition back to PA, which Clark says could take a couple weeks. Pete, he faces charges including assault and terroristic threats.
All right, KWLW's Vic Ragabathy with the latest. Thanks, Vic.
While authorities were able to stop a terror plot before it took place, it could have been a massacre. ABC's Peter Haralambos joined Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo with the details.
Hey, good morning. Really disturbing details in this complaint. They allege that this woman, 35-year-old Jessica Bowie, just last month began communicating with a confidential informant with the FBI, where she began detailing her plans to set off a bomb at the Albany Capitol building and try to kill as many people as possible, take out as much of the building as possible. It got to the point in which she even went out to buy bomb supplies, met with this confidential informant who gave her an inert handgun, inert explosives. Shortly after that meeting earlier this month, she was arrested on Wednesday. She's now been charged with providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization.
Yeah, and this all seems to have come together pretty quickly. She began planning this in July, and, you know, already we're hearing about this arrest. It seems like this all really happened in a flash.
That's right. Really, the timeline as detailed in this complaint begins on around July 16th when she began communicating with this informant, though they allege she converted to Islam about 5 years earlier and slowly became more and more radicalized. They allege her plan was to commit this attack, then flee to Syria, though she expressed a willingness to come back to the United States for other attacks in the future, mentioning considering the White House and Times Square on New Year's Eve as potential future targets.
Any idea why she picked Wednesday? I don't believe the state Senate was in session.
That's a great point you make. You're right, because there weren't any lawmakers there. And specifically when it came to her planning, she was saying how she wanted to choose a day when there are people there. She was hoping to maybe kill upwards of 100 lawmakers. She wanted to take out as much of the building as possible. She also mentioned wanting to destroy important documents at the Capitol. So it's unclear how sophisticated she was as an attacker, though she certainly made material steps to carry out this attack, going to, for example, a Home Depot. There's surveillance video showing her at that Home Depot checking out with a big box of nails, which she intended to use as shrapnel. There's also at least five instances when she actually went to the Capitol and took photos. She actually planned picnics and got coffee nearby so she could learn more about the security in the area. And on top of that, her plan was to use a DoorDash bag, one of the food delivery bags, to place this bomb somewhere in a way that it wouldn't get detected or at least cause suspicion.
How did this come about where they were able to track this down? Because it seems like, okay, this random woman we are hearing about, okay, she became increasingly more open about this online, was posting more and more radical things. But how did we know at all how investigators say that was picked up initially, how they got on the trail in the first place? Because I mean, there's so much posted online, you always wonder how this got on the radar.
Yeah, it's a great question, because even before she was communicating with the confidential informant, she was messaging random people online who she believed to be fellow ISIS supporters about her plans, saying in one message, quote, "I would like to target the state capitol in a way that I could get help and hop on a plane after, but I don't know if that's doable." That's to some unknown figure she believed was affiliated with ISIS. That being said, it seems like she got on the law enforcement's radar in part from her social media posts. She was posting on multiple accounts expressing support for ISIS. It appears that's how she got on their radar. And then really, the confidential informants that the FBI used here, at least two of them, according to the indictment, including to the complaint, really critical in foiling this plot.
Now that she is in custody, what does she face?
She faces up to 20 years in prison if she's convicted for that material support charge. It's interesting. The complaint alleges that after she was arrested, she told agents, quote, "There's no helping me. You guys have enough. There's no helping me. I'm going to prison for the rest of my life." Further saying, quote, "Material support is up to 20 years in prison. I already Googled it before. I know I'm going to jail."
Eleven-year-old Jacob Wetterling vanished from St. Joseph, Minnesota in 1989, and it left a lasting impact on the Twin Cities region. For decades, the mystery of what happened to this boy haunted his family, the people who knew him, and people who heard about his disappearance. When Chris Newberry, one of the people in that community who had been impacted by the Wetterling story, started making a documentary about the case, he didn't know that it would be turned on his head as he was working on the project. This week, Newberry joined Jason DeRussia of Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities to discuss the film called Echoes in the Night.
But tell me what it was. What's your story? I feel like everyone in Minnesota has a way that they got drawn in, besides just the fact that obviously it changed childhood for anybody that's in our age range, for sure.
Yeah, well, it's related. My story is related to what you were just talking about. I mean, I was 15 when Jacob was abducted. Jacob was 11. I lived in Minnetonka. That's where I grew up. And, you know, when that happened, all around Minnesota, certainly here in the Twin Cities, we were blasted with the news. It's continued to capture people's imagination here over the decades. And so the story really impacted me, like a lot of people my age. And, you know, basically anyone who was in Minnesota at that time, whether you were a kid, a parent, or just really anybody, you know, you were impacted by it and remember it well. So that's my story. When I was an adult and a parent myself, I was looking for a new project as a documentary filmmaker and, thought that why not try and tell that story?
What has some of the extra national attention that really came through that 2020 episode? I think that brought this story to the nation that to a certain degree, this has been our story when we finally got an answer as to what had happened. I mean, I think, you know, Chris, I moved here about 24 years ago, and I remember being a very young reporter sent out to interview Patty Wetterling in her house. And anybody who's been a reporter in this town long enough at some point interviewed Patty Wetterling. And it's one of those sort of, there are certain people that you meet and you say, whoa, like this is a different person to go through what she went through on a personal level. And then the fight for the national sort of registry of missing kids and what she has done with her pain over the years is amazing. And at the same point, that pain is such a part of her existence, right? You just can't imagine what it's like to lose your son in this fashion, especially.
Yeah. I mean, Patty's amazing. And the national news, I mean, when the abduction happened, and you can see some old clips in the film, it made national news. It was one of those really scary stories of a stranger abduction of a child. And so it did garner attention around the nation in 1989 when it happened. That sort of faded away for the national media. And as the years went by, there would be some TV specials, news specials on national TV that would bring attention to it again. There was, and maybe that's what you're alluding to, there was a very recent 2020 episode that did 2 hours on the Wetterling story. And we showed a few clips from our documentary and I was interviewed. So we were able to be a part of that this time around and bring some attention to our documentary through that 2020 episode. But
Well, Chris, yeah, and you're yeah. when you started working on this, and we're talking with Chris Newberry, who's the director of Echoes in the Night. You started working on this at, to say a fortuitous time would be understating the issue, because your team started working on this, what, the week when the perpetrator was arrested? I mean, you started in 2015, really, right? And that was yes. sort of go time for this, for a resolution that no one wanted, but thank goodness we got that bit of closure, right?
Yeah. So the arrest of Danny Heinrich happened in late 2015. And that was that happened to be just a coincidence that it was about, you know, a week and a half after I had, you know, had one final meeting with Patty and Jerry Wetterling to make sure that they were, you know, comfortable with going ahead with the documentary, and they obliged. And so then, you know, I was supposed to start filming with them, and I got a call from Patty Wetterling one morning and said, we're going to have to change our plans because something really big is happening. Turn on your TV. And that's when there was the press conference about the arrest. To their credit, they, even with this like big, you know, like a complete hurricane rushing through their lives again, this new big news about a big change in the case, they still were willing to let me be there. So I was filming there that first weekend after the arrest. Oh. Then 10 months later is when the finally there was the confession.
Yeah. Chris, when, you know, people have seen other documentaries, there have been other films on this, there's been news coverage, but your documentary has a number of elements that I think are going to be new and interesting for people. Tell people some of the things that make Echoes of the Night different.
Well, I mean, I think one of the big things is that, you know, there were, as we were just talking about, there was the confession in 2016, which was right on the heels of Danny Heinrich leading authorities to the place where they could find Jacob's remains. And so we found, you know, Jacob was found after all those years.
Yeah.
Now, what we kept doing is we continued to work on the film. You know, naturally, news media covered it for a little while, you know, unpacking some of the information we learned during the confession and covered some of the sentencing and that sort of thing. But over the months, naturally, the news media kind of went away to other things, right. But they stayed with it. And so I think one of the really unique things about what we captured was in the aftermath, learning how problematic the idea of closure can be for victims and survivors of crime, and just how complicated that can still be for people years after there's a quote unquote conclusion.
This was, you know, the fact that we're around state fair time, because I remember it was state fair time when the remains were found. And I got to tell you, like, I definitely, just like everybody in Minnesota, you sort of hoped, you kind of knew, you're like, yeah, he's probably dead. But there was hope, right, that someday, like maybe. And I just remember the profound sadness, and yet the fact that the Wetterlings didn't have to wonder anymore, you know? And you went right through some of those moments with them.
Yeah, to some degree. And we've captured, you know, at least the reflections on that weekend. We have a pretty profound moment in the film about that. And you were, Jason, you were probably at the state fair, because so many of the,
we're all brought back. I remember Frank and Amelia back in my Channel 4 days, but this was, Jennifer Mayerly, who was brand new at CCO. Bill Hudson was on this core story. Esme Murphy, Caroline Lowe. I remember it vividly.
And we're actually this year, just in next week or roundabout there, is going to be the 10-year mark of that confession.
Wow!
So yeah. we're right around the corner from that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was as you kind of mentioned, the people needed answers. Like, we really, we really wanted answers as just like the public watching from afar. Well, that we, like the story had like spellbound us for all those years. We really wanted answers too for ourselves, but especially for the Wetterling family. And of course they wanted answers, but it, you know, like it can't help but be mixed emotions when what the resolution is learning that we actually died that night.
A mother accused of strangling her three children to death. It's a case that's almost too gruesome to fathom. Yet it's not the first time a mother has taken her children's lives. And the Lindsay Clancy case has shed light on the challenges that families face in the postpartum period. Mothers are often exhausted and left to deal with physical, mental, and emotional changes that their bodies went through during childbirth. Sometimes they can suffer from postpartum depression, or the more rare postpartum psychosis condition. That's what Clancy's legal team says she was dealing with when she killed her kids. But does it explain the allegedly premeditated actions that she took? While Clancy has some dedicated defenders, others see her as evil. Conservative political commenter Matt Walsh, for example, said that he thinks she was simply selfish and hated her children. Kim St. Ong and Mark Cox of the Mark Cox Morning Show out of Odyssey Station KFTK in St. Louis discussed Walsh's comments and some of the other discourse around the Clancy case this week.
The trial for Lindsay Clancy is continuing today, but this is kind of when it all builds up and we wait to see what happens because they're expecting closing arguments and then the jury to start deliberating. Keep in mind, this is a Massachusetts mom, a former labor and delivery nurse, who prosecutors say that she strangled her three children at their home and then tried to jump out the window. She survived and is partially paralyzed. And the argument for her has been that she suffered from postpartum psychosis, that she heard voices and that led her to do that, and that she, for that reason, belongs in a psych ward, not convicted of first-degree murder and in prison. Now, I made the argument about this whole thing, and I had pretty strong feelings about something that Matt Walsh had said about postpartum depression. And I didn't suffer from postpartum depression with either of my two kids, but I have dealt with some stuff. And it can get kind of scary, the thoughts that go into your head. And so I was very irritated that Matt Walsh was saying that stuff. I actually unfollowed him. I just didn't want to deal with it. I thought it was completely just lack of taste, I guess, the way he completely, it seemed, completely dismissed any sort of like a mental thing going on after women have children. I think that's garbage if you want to pretend that that's not a thing. Now, do I think that that means that Lindsay Clancy is not guilty? No, I have not. I've never said that. I do think Lindsay Clancy is guilty. So you can say what Matt Walsh said was stupid, but also think that Lindsay Clancy deserves to be in prison, because when you look at the things, it's the way she went about it, it seems like it was very well planned out. And I know, Mark, you were talking about Allie Beth Stuckey during the commercial break, and that's someone who I have followed closely over the years. She's got a podcast called Relatable. And it sounds like she, what, changed her mind, her stance on this?
So this is about a 7.5 minute clip that she put out, which, let me summarize it before I play the part that I've edited for you here. She basically said that she misunderstood and she apologized because she truly believed that this woman was a victim of the medical system, and multiple doctors had put her on 13 different medicines that were conflicting and drove her into this psychosis. And she, not that she didn't think she was guilty of the action she took, but she thought that the circumstances of her guilt were altered by this medicine, and that should play a role in this trial. And she has since changed her mind after coming across some new information after listening to the actual evidence that was presented at trial.
So I heard that postpartum psychosis, which I had never heard of until this trial. I've heard of postpartum anxiety, postpartum depression, things like that. I heard that they attach that word postpartum to it because it automatically kind of triggers empathy. I mean, look at the way that these moms have come out and been supporting her. They are standing outside the courthouse and they're holding signs saying, "We are Lindsey Clancy." I think you can empathize with someone who's going through postpartum and the struggle that can come with that sometimes from a mental standpoint without in any way saying what you did is okay or that it justifies what you did. Because I know plenty of women who have struggled with postpartum depression because it is a very real thing. And it is concerning if you're on several medications at the same time and the way that those interact with one another, that is problematic and that's something that needs to be looked at. But you can't use that as a justification for, I went down and I strangled my three children.
Well, and there was intentionality to it, and there was planning and all of that. I can't envision this jury not finding her guilty of her actions and sentencing her to life in jail. I can't envision that scenario here.
While Clancy received mental health diagnoses before the killings, she was not diagnosed with postpartum psychosis until after they took place.
Wow. And I did not know that.
Mm-mm. No, I've followed a little bit. I've tuned in when I can. But man, I mean, this has been going on for weeks, so it's hard to tune into all of it. Someone on the social media was asking how old her kids were. So she had a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and an 8-month-old, which is just so tragic. She sent her husband, it's seen in a text, sent him on an errand. Hey, do you want to pick up some takeout? I think she even had him go on one more additional errand. And clearly wanted the time to be able to do this, to be alone in the house with the kids. So I don't know how you wouldn't be able to say then that would be first degree murder, because the difference between first degree murder and second degree murder is that first degree murder is planned out versus second degree murder is, for example, you catch someone cheating and in the heat of the moment you kill them.
Right,
that's still murder, but it's second degree versus, oh, you plan this out. You research how long this is going to take for your husband to run this errand and you made sure that he was out of the house. That's first degree murder.
It was hard to listen to yesterday that witness described him arriving home, finding her outside, worried about her, calls 911, waits for a neighbor to get there and says, then he says, I'm going to go in and check on the kids. And he walks into the house and finds all three of his children dead.
I can't even wrap
my
brain around that.
It's just the most tragic case.
Scoot out of Odyssey Station WWL in New Orleans also weighed in on the Clancy case this week. He connected it to the case of Susan Smith, a mother who was convicted of killing her two sons in South Carolina.
People just can't imagine killing your children. Lindsey Clancy's trial is going on. It's getting close to the end, getting close to going to the jury, and it will be interesting to see how long it takes them to come to a decision about her guilt or innocence. She is charged with killing her three children with, I think, elastic exercise bands. She choked them to death and then jumped out of a second-story window. Social media is ablaze with theories about the father really doing it, because the father is already remarried to somebody who kind of looks like his ex-wife. The theory is that the father wanted to get out of the marriage, didn't want the kids, wanted his new life with this new woman, and so he killed the kids and pushed her out of the second-story window, making it seem as if she did it, and she jumped out of the second-story window to commit suicide. She's in a wheelchair as a result of that, but she is, obviously not dead. She's in court. Just let me bring you up to date before I get back to some of your text messages. After about a month of testimony, the jurors in this case are continuing to hear from final witnesses in the case about the woman who strangled her kids. A forensic psychologist hired by the prosecution to evaluate Lindsey Clancy's history basically says the defense claimed that she had acute postpartum psychosis is something that is a factor. It's a rare mental illness that can follow a childbirth. Kirk Heilburn, who is the psychologist, he told jurors that he didn't believe that the woman's claim that she has hallucinated a voice telling her to kill our children is accurate. The kids ranged from 8 months to 5 years old. She had recently stopped breastfeeding her 8-month-old as she continued to, according to her own admission, suffer from mental health issues. She checked herself into a mental hospital at one point, and she just cried out in a lot of ways. The prosecution is saying that she didn't take her medicine properly. The defense is saying that the medicines were working against each other and turned into a volatile situation. Again, this is an interesting story because it, and by the way, the courtroom has been packed every day in the latter days of this. She had been seeking help, and she had told people that she never talked about, according to witnesses, she did not talk about killing her children, but she did say she had suicidal thoughts. And she apparently was suffering from postpartum depression, which, again, is one of the things that is at the focus of this case, something that a lot of men don't relate to because they can't. I mean, I can't relate to it. But I believe women who say they have this issue. A lot of men don't even believe it. Say, it's just a farce. It's just a phony thing. Women are just making excuses. I don't believe that. Now, again, I'm not a woman, so I can't tell you for sure. But it just seems like there was a lot going on here. And it might be the system that really failed this woman and really failed the children. Because the three children are dead. You know, and that's the saddest part of all of this, that the three kids are dead. And this really brings back memories of the case of Susan Smith. Remember Susan Smith? I know many of you remember this case. Susan Smith was convicted of killing her two sons. She seatbelted them into the car, and she let the car drift into this lake and sink. And I think it took 16 minutes for the car to totally sink. And her two boys drowned in the back of that car. And Susan Smith immediately blamed a black man for making her get out of the car, carjacking her car with her two sons in it, at gunpoint. And there was a nationwide search for this mythical black man that was mythical. He didn't even do it. But it's sad that Susan Smith thought that this would be okay, that people would believe that a black man did this. She finally admitted that she killed her two sons. And from the beginning, I remember talking about this on the air. From the beginning of this case with Susan Smith, it just did not seem like she was telling the truth. It seemed like she was making this up all along, and I remember saying that I don't believe the story about the black man doing this. I think that I think she killed her kids, and as it turned out, she killed her kids. I think the prosecution wanted the death penalty, but she got life in prison. She was up for parole, and she argued that she is very sorry for what she did. If she could take it all back and not do what she did, she would do that, but she can't. She was denied parole. And so, you know, this is a woman who she, you know, it's hard to know or to understand what people are thinking or feeling when they kill their children. I mean, just think about what that would take. And I know many of you are imagining your kids or your grandkids, and you just can't even fathom the idea that somebody would do this. But there are women who do this, and some of it is linked to a postpartum depression. But I think, you know, if you kill your kids, you have to deal with the consequences, and there have to be consequences. You know, maybe as a society, we can have some understanding for the reason of postpartum depression, postpartum psychoses. We can understand that may have driven somebody to do something, but I don't think those things are an excuse for what was done. And I think you have to, you know, spend some time or life in prison as a result of that. You know, because, you know, too often people don't speak for the children. People don't speak for the child that is dead in a situation. And we talk about the mother, or we talk about the father, we talk about something that's gone on, or why something happened accidentally. We talk about all of that, but we don't speak for the children who can't speak for themselves. And to me, that's a true tragedy. But You know, when I started hearing about this case, I immediately started thinking about the Susan Smith case, and just many of us remember what an extensive story that was, and then the lie about a black man taking a gun and forcing her out of the car and killing her kids, and then she finally broke and admitted that she had done it, and she is still in prison today.
On the Adam and Jordana Show out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, Adam Carter and Jordana Green extensively discussed the Clancy case this week. Green shared her own experience with postpartum anxiety and depression, more common conditions than the postpartum psychosis condition, under the microscope in Clancy's trial.
But help me understand something, if you will, and I'm talking to you, Jor, or our listeners. Help me understand why there is so much support for Lindsay Clancy. This is a woman who killed her three children. Mm-hmm. Her trial is going on right now. I think it's almost at its conclusion. I really haven't paid much attention to this story.
Because it's hard to watch.
That, and I'm just not, like, this is a story that really does nothing for me. Like, mm-hmm. you know, these high-profile, either celebrity or murder cases. My attention was drawn to the story because there are so many people that are supporting her. And
yes,
I'm wondering why. Now, that I understand that they're, part of this is the question of postpartum depression, mm-hmm. which I know is a very real thing. I know people who have dealt with it, but those people didn't kill their kids because of it.
They did not.
And I just find it strange that there's this huge support of this woman. And can you help me understand why that is?
I can. And this is a very sensitive story, and it's awful, and it's tragic, and it's horrific. And for those who haven't been looking on social media or who have been turning away, the story is basically that Lindsay Clancy, she's 36-year-old mom of three. By the way, she was a former labor and delivery nurse. So she knows, she understands gestation, postpartum, you know, she understands bringing babies into the world. She's on trial for first-degree murder, and no one is disputing that she killed those babies.
She doesn't dispute it.
Cora was five, Dawson was three, and Callan was 8 months. So for those that are first hearing about this, after Lindsay strangled her children to death, she jumped out of a window to kill herself in an attempted suicide, and she did not succeed, obviously, and she became paralyzed from the waist down. So she is in court now on these charges, of course, of murdering her children, and she knows she did it, and everybody knows she did it. But her defense team is saying she was in the grips of not postpartum depression, Adam, and this is where your question comes in. Yes, she had postpartum depression, and all of us do. I did. I had to be medicated for it. I had terrible thoughts about neglecting my children when I had postpartum depression. That is real, and many, many women have postpartum depression. In fact, PPD, postpartum depression, affects 1 in 7 new mothers. That is a high
That's
amount.
A
and, you know, older generations used to call it the baby blues. Mm-hmm. And it's because a physiological thing happens. The hormones that you were having in your body for 9 months to grow this human have now all been released. You're now getting no sleep. You have less hormones. You're recovering from a traumatic event, passing a human through your vagina and giving it life. And maybe you're nursing now. And there comes with other things. But postpartum depression is defined as deep sadness, severe fatigue, anxiety, and yet mothers are aware that they feel sad. Mothers are aware that they have responsibilities. They're aware of, they're in reality. They're living in the world. Postpartum psychosis, PPP, is rare. It affects 1 or 2 people per 1,000 mothers. Okay, so it's not unheard of, yeah. But it's more rare. And what happens with PPP? You get hallucinations. Command delusions. We've often heard other women. There was another mother who killed her 5 children by drowning them in a bathtub. She heard the devil telling her that the devil is in these kids and she has to kill those kids. And she did. Mm. Also, with postpartum psychosis, you are in a complete break from reality. You are not living in the world. You have a loss of your rational capacity. You have a loss of judgment. You are, I guess, technically insane. You don't have control of what you do. Now, this woman still murdered her three children, correct, and she cannot walk among us. She cannot. It's very sad that that happened to her, but she is an unsafe person to be around because she has had a break with reality. And she probably wouldn't even, she would probably say, I need to be in a mental hospital
right
for my whole life. The reason there are women dressed in pink outside of the courthouse is because so many of us have had postpartum depression. Some have had psychosis, and there isn't enough support and help
okay
for women. Because even if you don't have postpartum depression, there still is not enough support, in my opinion, for mothers. It is an overwhelming, just enormous responsibility when you have a small child. And not just one, two, three. It gets harder as you have more. Not to say you shouldn't have more, but also postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis, it gets worse with every pregnancy.
Yeah.
So even if you were fine with the first one, I didn't have any baby blues, I'm totally fine. The next one, it will get more severe. And that's what happened with mine. I didn't know I had postpartum depression with the first one. I just thought, oh, it's baby blues, it's loss of hormones. By the time Ruby came, my third child, mm-hmm, I needed to be medicated.
Yeah.
I didn't lose reality, but I couldn't get out of bed. I was clinically depressed. And, I mean, it was really bad. So I needed to be medicated. So I understand that. I understand the diagnosis. And I think the support just comes from sympathy. No one is supporting a woman who murdered her three children. She should not, like I said, she should not walk among us, mm-hmm, and she should be punished for that. But I think what they're trying to do is shine a light on moms need more help.
Okay.
Moms need more help. And also, this woman, Lindsay Clancy, was begging for help. She was on three different kinds of medications to help her. She had told her doctor. She had told her husband. She had asked for help and was being medicated for it. It just wasn't working. They had had a nanny, but I guess they decided as a couple to let the nanny go, which, after you make a note, friends, if your wife says to you, I don't trust myself around the children and I hear voices telling me to hurt them, you don't fire the nanny. You also maybe don't let that woman be alone with the children. You take some sick time from work and you help in the morning. You hire full-time help. You have a mom move in or a trusted person. You, when somebody has postpartum psychosis, and this woman was diagnosed with it, she should not have been allowed to be alone with her children. And the system and her husband and her support system and her family failed her epically. Not only her, they failed those children who are now dead.
The medical, the doctors for sure. I mean, and I'm not willing to blame the husband. I don't know enough about the story, mm-hmm, to say the husband saw these warning signs and still said, oh, we're going to be fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For all those points, I totally agree. We need to shine a light on it, especially if women aren't getting help 100%. Mm-hmm. But I think about the Hopkins daycare and the guy who killed mm-hmm his wife and his child in front of other kids. And that takes a certain mental break mm-hmm for you to do that. And I understand that, but I also don't want to forgive somebody for, we shouldn't forgive people for doing that.
No. And I look, maybe some of these women are saying that, but I certainly don't agree with that. Lindsay Clancy is a severely mentally, emotionally profoundly
broken
person. Yes. And now also, when she comes back to reality, because people, of course, can recover from postpartum psychosis. Of course you can, if you are medicated with the right things, if you have the right care, if you get a break. She was suffering from severe insomnia. You know why? Because 8-month-old babies don't often sleep through the night. And if you're nursing them, like so many of our pediatricians just say, nursing is the best, and they pressure you into doing that, and they don't give moms a break, and they make you feel guilty if you don't nurse.
Yeah.
You know, then you're the one doing it. So I have a lot of sympathy. Again, this woman should go to a mental institution for the rest of her life, or if she's recovered, prison, whatever it is. but there does need to be more access to help, more believing women when they are struggling, whether it becomes if you get a diagnosis that you, your healthcare has to automatically pay for 24-hour care, no matter what that looks like, or, you know, 8 hours of care if you're alone with your babies, whatever it is, we need to protect the children and the moms.
Yes.
And let them recover. So yes, it is weird to see these women outside saying Me Too, what's her name? Lancey?
Lindsay Clancy.
I'm sorry. Me Too, Lindsay. You know, we hear you, Lindsay. We support you, Lindsay. She needed that support before she murdered her three children.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we're not set up as a society. Again, it goes back to my multi-generational living idea. We're not set up as a society to help young mothers. And I take responsibility for mine. I moved away from my family. And I didn't have my mother or my sister. You know, I moved halfway across the country to find a job. And my husband and I settled here. And I didn't have the support of family. My mom came for like a little while, you know, when my kids were born. But then they go back to their own lives. My parents were still working. And I suffered. I didn't have psychosis, you know, but it's real. And so I have empathy for everybody in this situation. I also really wonder, I would love to say that her husband bears the responsibility, but you cannot make somebody else responsible for a different person's bad deeds. You know,
right.
The sins of the father and the son. You can't do that.
Plus, they were. It's not like her husband was preventing her from getting treatment. They were getting treatment and they were getting guidance.
Right. She was on a couple of different drugs. For some reason, the nanny had been let go. And I don't know why she was left alone with this child. And hindsight is 20/20. It's really hard to say to somebody, you have to have 24/7 care.
Right.
I mean, that's almost impossible.
Right.
But
good luck paying for that.
Good luck paying for that. That's right. But the fact that this woman was left alone with her children with deadly consequences should be a lesson for all of us.
So I think you laid it out beautifully why there are at least support for to draw the attention on her. But I still have a very strong reaction to, you know, supporting a woman who killed her three children. So we're talking about the Lindsay Clancy story, and I just started out by wondering why there's so much support. And I think, Jory, you did a marvelous job of educating me that it's not support for her saying, boy, she should be released, that she didn't do wrong. It's more of shining the light on what is a very serious problem.
Yes.
On postpartum psychosis.
Yes.
Which is a furtherment of postpartum depression, which is way too common. And I think those are all great points. But that doesn't automatically say, well, she should be, you know, forgiven. Or,
oh, God, no.
That's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Some of the texts are fascinating.
Yes, let's get to some of these here.
For example, hold on. I don't know if the support is for her specifically. I think it's to highlight for women in the healthcare system who don't get the treatment they need. Absolutely. Didn't the woman repeatedly try to get help? Yes, she did. We mentioned that. She was on three different medications. She had told her husband and either her mother or her mother-in-law that she did not trust herself around the children, that she has had thoughts of hurting the children. Now, I mean, here's where some responsibility has to lay with the people that were around her. If you say, I might hurt our children, like if my husband had said, I might hurt our children, I would not let him be alone with the children without supervision until he got the help he needed to say, I feel like I can be trusted and I am well, and had a, you know, a psychological analysis that's saying, yes, this medication is working for him and he is better. The fact that the mother said that and nobody either listened or said, medication will take care of it, or, oh, I'm only going out for 20 minutes and left her alone. I mean, there's some responsibility. I'm not saying it's criminal. But boy, there's some responsibility on the husband for not helping more, in my opinion.
Well, I think he's obviously devastated by what has happened here. And I mean, we don't know, like in the conversation that they had before he went out or whatever, like how she is telling. I mean, certainly if she's like saying, my God, don't leave me, I don't know what I'm going to do. That's one thing. But if she's having a good day and says, oh, I feel really good, I'm turning the corner here, and and that's why I'm not ready to, you know, blame him for any part of this.
Okay. Someone said, my daughter's friend had PPD. After her baby was born, her mom stayed with her for a month. Then her sister came and stayed for weeks. After they left, she bought a gun, killed the baby, then killed herself. This is a serious issue. That is devastating. I am so sorry to read that on the radio, but it's real. And this is the story that didn't make the news. I mean, maybe it did at the time, but I'm honestly, like, this is a horrible tragedy, but I'm glad we're talking about it.
Absolutely. And here, a texter mentions this too. And this is kind of why my initial thought was what it was, is being attracted to a cult of personality, like the people cheering for the guy who shot and killed Brian Thompson. That, I'll be honest with you, I was wondering, is this the same type of situation? It's not.
It is not. No.
The people who are cheering on Brian Thompson, or Luigi Mangione, I think that is a whole different thing.
Right.
And I think that is wrong, and that's sick.
Right, that is a hate cult that is supporting death and murder to further your cause.
Right.
So, incorrect.
Correct. This is totally different from what this is. Mm-hmm.
Adam and Jordana also spoke to a caller who told them he had his own experience dealing with postpartum psychosis, though his story had a happy ending.
Here another text here. I have a family member who had postpartum psychosis and fortunately got the treatment and family support. Her child is now 2.5 and thriving. Oh, so God. Fortunate that there's care out there. Yeah, that is absolutely a heartening story. Brian is called in from Columbus. Brian, you have a story you want to share? Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I sent you guys a text.
Yeah.
My wife back in 1989 suffered from postpartum psychosis. Our firstborn, it was 3 months after he was born. And, you know, as a husband, I saw nothing to lead me to believe that there was going to be a problem. She traveled to Phoenix to visit her parents, just she and the baby. And she was fine when she left. I got a couple phone calls for her, although the last phone call that I talked to her on, she seemed a little off. But at the time, you know, I didn't put sure. two and two yep. together. Needless to say, she decided that, well, she, under her condition, she thought she was responsible for the AIDS epidemic and tried to kill herself and our son while visiting her parents.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a very tough time in our life. But both are fine. We ended up having to hire a lawyer. She wasn't allowed to come home because she had charges filed against her. And ended up in a mental health facility in the Phoenix area for a few months. And it took us about 6 months to get through the court case and get her back home. She's, you know, obviously feels terrible about it. It really changed her life, and she became very introverted with the people who surround her because she was so embarrassed about what had happened and thought people would hate her if they ever found out what she done, you know, what had happened.
Can you share with us how, first of all, was it you who filed charges or was it the state of Arizona that filed charges? And did you agree with her going to the mental institution?
Oh, it was the state of Arizona that filed charges. And I agreed with her going because the choice was she was either going to be in jail or she was going to be in a mental health facility.
Got it. What did this do to your marriage?
Yeah, that's what my question is. How do you move past that, Brian?
Well, you know, did I think she did this on purpose? Absolutely not. You know, this is my wife. I married her for better or for worse, and worse happened. We got through it. We've been married 40 years, and life is grand.
How's your child now?
He is doing quite well. He's out in the working world. He's, you know, the only thing he has is he had an eye injury because she was going to drink toilet bowl cleaner if anybody walked in on her as part of her thing, and she spilled a little and got in his eye. Mm. But that was the only injury.
And their relationship is good now?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He knows what happened.
So,
you know, we talked to him about it.
Can you also share a little bit about what her treatment was like? She was in the mental, you know, an institution, and clearly she needed help and she needed medicine. She needed to get better. Can you share with us how they helped her get over this, or what the treatment was done?
Well, they heavily medicated her is really what they did. Mm-hmm. And she's been medicated, you know, on different mental health meds ever since. And to this day, she is. And throughout the years, she has tried, you know, well, I don't think I need that anymore. And she's landed in facilities based on stopping to take her medication. I think she finally realizes, though, that in order for her to be normal, she needs to take these meds.
Yes. Did she have emotional issues before the postpartum psychosis?
No, there was absolutely nothing.
No warning.
See, that's another thing. Right. It's not like you have to have a history of mental illness. This can be brought on by the changes in your body. Yeah. Through giving birth.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was 3 months after, which, you know, they did mention that, you know, that's when changes start happening after childbirth. So it was like right as those changes happened is when this episode happened.
We'll end this week's dive into the Clancy case in the courtroom. Jury deliberations are expected to continue on Monday. Here's the Dana and Parks show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City discussing the court proceedings this Thursday.
And there was some discussion today as they're wrapping everything up as far as testimony goes that one of the experts said to the jury that this was deliberate, that she knew what she was doing.
Now, this was a prosecution
yes,
witness.
And I've said this before. I will say it again. I want to have had to have sat through what those poor, isn't there 12, 18 of them? It's a whole bunch of jurors.
12 of them are women.
12
and
women,
six men.
They'll figure out once prosecution and defense rests, they will figure out which one of those are alternates. But there's 18 seated.
Yeah. So court ended today. Everybody's gone home. The jury was sent home, so they are not being sequestered. This is from ABC News. The jury's been sent home for the day as the evidence portion of the trial has concluded. The judge is holding a charge conference, which is set for 2:30 p.m., so that has already happened or is underway, to hash out how the jury should be instructed on the law. Closing arguments begin tomorrow morning.
It is. This came up in our own family last night. I asked one of the kids, have you been following this? And they said, I know enough to be dangerous off and on, but they said, like, we can't just excuse this. We can't just say, well, she was out of her mind. Well, of course she was out of her mind. I mean, the opinions on this are so strong. There are throngs of people just showing up to court to support her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying she doesn't deserve, you know, her family is there and understanding if, you know, from other women maybe who have been through this, but I would not want to be on that jury.
You'd vote guilty, wouldn't you?
How do you not? But then, okay, of course she's not in her right mind. She did what she did. Of course she was off her rocker, right? No one in their right mind would do what she did.
You would have to be.
But how many homicides will we say that about? Almost all of them.
No, not at all. A lot of people kill out of revenge.
Vengeance. Okay, you would take those off the table.
I mean, I would argue most of the murders in America are just rage killings. You know, you did me wrong, I'm going to kill you. Whether it's a bad drug deal or, you know, whatever, you left me, so now you and your new boyfriend are going to have to die. That is not not guilty by reason of insanity. That is guilty. Goodbye. You're going, or robbery.
Yeah.
That turned into a murder. I mean, these are not people who are insane. These are people who are very sane, who knew exactly what they were doing when they went into the convenience store with a gun and demanded all the money out of the cash register and then decided to kill the only witness. That's not insanity. That is sanity and sick.
One of the last witnesses today was an FBI psychiatrist who testified that he does not believe her account that she heard a voice. And we talked, you know, ordering her to do this.
And only she would be able to say whether she did or did not.
Well, one of the things that was interesting, they had somebody on the stand at some point that said with an audio hallucination, okay, mm-hmm. that people who hear things legitimately have mental health struggles and they are hearing voices, that's not a one and done. Like it almost, they almost made it sound like you're hearing voices continually, okay? Mm-hmm. And you seek treatment for that, or you don't hear voices. You don't never ever mention one single time that you've never ever ever heard a voice in your head. Mm-hmm. And then something heinous happens and you say, well, I heard a voice right before I did it. Say do this. I don't know. I honestly feel so bad for those jurors. It would upend your life. You're going to need therapy for a long time after this.
Because of the pictures.
Oh my God, yeah. Scott, you would not want to be seated in that courtroom.
I wouldn't want to be seated on any jury, but definitely not one like this. I would not want to be. I remember a handful of times in my career covering a murder trial.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a choice. It was my job. And I had to cover it. And I remember my first murder trial ever was in Ottawa, Kansas at KOFO. And when I was working there it would have been 1994, 95. And there was a 15-year-old boy who was being tried as an adult because he got into an altercation at a local park with a man.
Yeah.
And he was an older guy, you know, north of 40. I remember that. I don't remember how old he was. And this 15-year-old buried a 7-iron into his head and killed him. And that was my first ever murder trial. And I just remember, I don't remember seeing any pictures of the victim in that case.
It stays with you. All of that stays with you.
Yeah. You know, they had the coroner in and everything. And I just remember, man, I thought my first murder trial, I'm like, oh, I get to cover my first murder trial. I was very excited in a weird, sick way. But I just remember when that trial was over, I was like, that was nothing like I thought it would be. And it was gross and the testimony was hard to hear.
Dana Wright and Scott Parks also discussed a bizarre development in the courtroom gallery.
Did you see yesterday someone seated in the gallery? I think they work for Vanity Fair. Look this up.
At the Clancy case?
Is in trouble because someone snapped a photo during a recess or like whatever. Someone snapped a photo and she was smiling. How many times have you seen on a reverse shot at a crime scene and an officer or an assistant district attorney is there mm-hmm. and they're kind of chuckling? You know, maybe it's 3 hours after the homicide has happened. And is that disrespectful? Are you not like during a break in court, Scott, are you not allowed to lean over and say something to the person sitting next to you that has nothing to do with the trial? Like, did you hear about that good ad? Damn, you know, like, or just right. to, and officers will tell you this sometimes because they have to see all of the awful stuff they see.
Okay, so this was from the New York Post.
Yeah.
A reporter in a green dress has sparked backlash. A reporter
yes.
in a green dress has sparked backlash for grinning and winking at the camera during the murder trial of Lindsay Clancy. And she has been bounced from her gig with Vanity Fair.
Yeah, I don't think she should have winked.
Can't explain the wink.
Yeah, a live court TV camera panned along a row of journalists in the courtroom gallery Monday when it caught Brittany Romano apparently hamming it up with a smile and a wink as other reporters looked stone-faced. The trial is over. They give the background on the case here. All right, so here she is. I'm going to show you a picture of her. And there is a row of five female journalists, and they're all standing up. I'm assuming the judge is coming in.
And she's kind of smiling.
She looks like she's at a party having the time of her life.
Ever been caught during, and court is a great example, or even like, let's say church, where you're supposed to be dialed in. We're supposed to be serious here. Mm-hmm. and someone looks down and says something, and you're like, to,
but it's Dana, like, the more wink.
Like a, no, I can't defend the wink. It's more like, I don't want to say a defense mechanism, but even police officers will tell you, like, if you catch me, like, grinning outside of a homicide scene, it's not because I'm not serious about my job or I'm not really good at my job.
You're breaking the tension.
Like, sometimes you just have to, like, after something so awful.
Yeah. But can you imagine what the reaction would be for if you were, go back to being a reporter at Channel 5 for a minute.
And you wink at the, yeah, you can't wink at the camera.
No. And you're at a double homicide, okay? And you're... camera guy is panning across the street looking for some good B-roll, and he passes the camera eye passes by two cops, and one of the cops looks over at the Channel 5 camera and just smiles
winks,
and goes
right, yeah.
And winks at the camera. That cop would be in trouble.
It's not a great look. I guess. I don't know.
And I think it depends on the context of the trial. Maybe after a verdict, right? If it's something somebody's happy for. Like, what I'm kind of thinking about is, I don't know if you guys remember, the Arizona Cardinals quarterback, Derek Anderson, smiled and was laughing on the sideline back in 2010 when they were losing 27-6. And he had an infamous post-game rant about that. Not a good look.
There's more to it. The story about the reporter, Brittany Romano,
in the green dress.
From Vanity Fair, okay? That... the smaller girl, describe this picture.
It looks like they're in a New Year's Eve hat, two little girls, and they're just
two little girls, probably
beaming ear to ear.
Like seven or eight.
Seven or eight.
Okay. The girl on the left, that's Brittany Romano from Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
Care to guess the name of the girl on the right?
No idea.
Lindsay Clancy.
Oh, my.
They know each other from childhood.
Oh, my. What are the odds?
That's Lindsay Clancy right there.
I think they convict her, Scott.
That changes.
I'm
going to
say it right now. I think she's convicted. And I think she's convicted based on, in part, on the testimony of the psychiatrist who says, you don't just never hear a voice in your head. And then this happens, and she says, well, I heard this one voice telling me to do this. Yeah. And then, by the way, she said she never heard the voice again. He said, it doesn't work like that.
I'm torn on this.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to 1010 Winds in New York, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, Jason DeRussia and the Adam and Jordana Show out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, The Mark Cox Morning Show out of KFTK in St. Louis, Scoot out of WWL in New Orleans, and The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast, on the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.